I think the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:10 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 14th. Something that I was thinking about over the last 24 hours was when I was writing Crowd Money, I was making the argument that we were going to have a big bull market, and I wrote the book between 2011 and 12, and it was published in 2013. And back then, it was looking like the USA was going to become energy independent, and that's already happened. And back then, that was a maverick idea, but now it's pretty much well understood. And the Russian invasion of Ukraine is already just a byproduct of the USA's independence, so that they don't really have to take into account anything that's happening around the world with any other producers, because they don't have to import anymore. And the selling off of the strategic reserve is another factor. Why would you need to sustain a large strategic reserve with millions and millions of barrels of oil when you are energy independent? So that's an additional factor. Then I was, what are the other things that were supporting this massive bull market? Well, the next one was the rise of the global consumer. We were in a disinflationary environment, and emerging markets were surging. We'd had a huge recovery off the lows in 2009, but the dollar peaked in, excuse me, the dollar bottomed in 2011 and 12. So emerging markets didn't weren't stock markets weren't doing quite as well, but still productivity was growing and emerging markets were continuing to do well. Now we're in an inflationary environment and we're seeing protest movements cropping up everywhere. So the US rail workers are about to go on strike, and UK rail workers have been on strike on multiple occasions for the last 6 months. I think it's inevitable we're going to start to see nurses going on strike because they feel like they've been abused during the pandemic. And everyone is complaining about their wages not rising, or and if they are rising, not keeping pace with inflation and not rising fast enough or rising often enough. And then, of course, you have all of these countries and companies that had borrowed in US dollars. I was looking at Bank of International Settlements data, and they estimate that there's about $560 billion has been lent out to Chinese corporations. So most of that money is in the property sector. And that is obviously a risk, but it's a much bigger risk when property prices are going down. So then, of course, we have the geopolitical component. Back in 2011 and 12, that was before Xi Jinping took power, and everything was still looking pretty rosy in terms of globalization. There was this still strong economic growth coming out of the emerging markets, increasing demand, and we were coming out of a major contraction, so there was a lot of liquidity floating around, and it certainly helped to sustain the bull market. But of course, then over the course of the last decade, Xi Jinping is now looking at extending his term, having had two consecutive 5-year terms, and the geopolitical risk has certainly increased. Then we have technological innovation. And technological innovation is a disinflationary force, but it was the fourth really big theme. So we had the USA's energy independence, the march of globalization, then not only the march of globalization, but the rise of the global consumer, which was increasing sales for the largest companies in the world. And then on top of all that, you had technological innovation. And the companies that generate the innovation prosper, but more often than not, it is the consumers of that technology do even better. So the Nasdaq has been the best performing index in the world over the course of the last decade. It's done pretty much nothing but rise. And every time it has paused, and it has paused on plenty of occasions, it has found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Every time we've seen quantitative easing withdrawn and less liquidity made available, we've had medium-term corrections, and each one of those, whether in 2010, 11, 15 and 16, 18 or 20, we've seen it finding support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it bounced from it again in June of this year. But there is an important difference. On this occasion, the Federal Reserve did not stop raising interest rates and did not provide lots of additional new money. Instead, they are accelerating the pace of quantitative tightening and continuing to raise interest rates because inflationary pressures are still present. And this is quite a different situation to what we had back in 2011. In 2010 and 11, even 12, people were still worried about the second shoe falling. They were still worried that the aftershock of the global financial crisis would have a disastrous effect on sentiment. And then, of course, we had the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe, and there was a lot of fears about the euro simply disintegrating, and that representing a huge problem. But through all of those worries, the NASDAQ 100 continued to march higher. It was around 2017 that it finally broke out to new all-time highs, and we can see that that was definitely a really significant event because it accelerated after that. And between 2016, when the price initially crossed the 4,800 point level, well, then it peaked eventually closer to 17,000. So that's a really impressive advance. And there is absolutely no questioning that this was a very clear acceleration between the low in 2020 and the peak at the end of last year. We had a meaningful pullback, a sharp rebound from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and now the price is pulling back again. But then let's think about those characteristics that really did help to support the bull market. So the energy sector and the evolution of US energy independence is already priced in. Technological innovation was primarily about the benefits that could be gleaned from 4G and wireless connectivity. So that led to the evolution of the cloud, of the, first we have the cloud, then we have the iPhone, all of the apps. So these were major innovations. And we've had Apple do fantastically well out of that. The same with Amazon, Microsoft, and Google as well, because those three companies are the big data center providers. Tesla has been able to iterate because of its ability to market via the internet. They don't have a dealer network. Then they've been able to simplify the designs. And that's all down to technology as well. And then they can also send updates to the car over the internet. So that's an additional iteration on that same trend. NVIDIA is another example that they produce chips, and those chips go into data centers. They go into crypto mining. They go into gaming PCs. Netflix has completely disrupted the viewing of shows, but they've done so by using the internet. So the linkage between all of those exceptionally large companies is 4G and the cloud. So basically, it was another internet boom. Now, if we look at those eight companies, then this is looking like a downtrend. We have a sequence of ranges, one below the last. We have a sequence of lower rally highs, and The Fang Man Index is pulling back, and it has contracted from a market cap of 12 trillion to 8 and change. So it's already a big pullback, and it could go down further because bond yields are rising. Now, the bond yield popped on the upside yesterday and was holding on to the majority of that move in here today. The producer price index also came in strong today, and that followed the CPI figure yesterday. The shock value has eroded, and investors are now beginning to give some credence, although it isn't fully priced in, that the Federal Reserve will raise rates by 100 basis points. Now, I think that's probably a bit too much, that they don't want to scare the market, but they could easily go for 75 basis points. And if they go for 75 basis points, then it is very likely that the 10-year minus the 3-month yield curve spread will become inverted. And I think this is important. First, I think that the 10-year minus the 2-year is the more reliable indicator. And historically, that is the case. 10-year minus 3-month tends to be more volatile. So that's one thing. But Jay Powell, when this spread was up there around 2.25%, 225 basis points, he highlighted this one as saying there's no tightness in the liquidity markets. Look at this spread. So they might have just been cherry picking at the time, and we shouldn't give it too much credence. But the reality is that they were watching it. So as this becomes inverted, it will certainly start to ring some bells that we are in a very tight liquidity environment. Now, when we look at the actual yield curve, and I need to put up a bond to get that up. Well, what we see then is a very flat curve overall. Between about 6 months and 10 years, we're already inverted. We're not quite there yet with 3 month, but every yield between 6 months and 3 years is higher than the 20-year and the 30-year. Now, it's quite normal that before a recession starts, the entire yield curve will be inverted, and not just the yield curve or the sovereign bond yield curve, but that we'll also see other yield curves become inverted. So, the Muni spread is not quite there yet, and it's not a necessary component, but it is certainly contracting down to 36 basis points. And then let's look at the high yield sovereign, or the high yield curve spread, and it's trending lower and doing so in a really quite consistent fashion. So it's almost inevitable at this stage there will be a recession. The only possible way that they could avoid it would be to further stoke inflation, which would be to stop raising rates, in fact, cut rates and boost additional liquidity. But I think it's very unlikely they're going to do that. I think they're going to keep tightening until they break something. And there's quite a few things that could break. So, when we think about where are the epicenters of risk, well, Chinese property is an epicenter of risk. It has been massively inflated because Chinese consumers have had nowhere else to put their money. So, as prices come back down, it exposes the leverage within the system. There are two big stories relating to it. The first is that people had decided they're going to stop paying their mortgages. But then there's also another growing trend of people prepaying their mortgages. Now, one of the issues with rapid prepayments is that the bonds mature early and it robs the investor of cash flows. So it's one of the idiosyncrasies of the mortgage market, that you're not going to have as many bonds reach maturity as you might anticipate. And rapid prepayments means that banks end up with more cash and nowhere to lend it. So then, what it in fact does is prepayments, especially when they occur on scale, have a damaging effect on the credit multiplier. And that's rather important when prices are falling. You want, if you're going to stimulate, what you're trying to do is to stimulate the credit multiplier effect. So certainly China is potentially problematic. And if they then go ahead and stimulate in a big way, well, then there's the real potential that they're going to stoke inflationary pressures. So the Shanghai Property Index, which is most of the government-owned property developers, remains at going in a range and going sideways. Now they're starting to close in on Fushan Group. And Fushan Group has been one of those companies that's been extremely acquisitive. So the hammer is falling on Fushan International right now, and the price is trending downwards. So there's no real indication yet that the selling pressure in China is over, or that they're willing to do what's necessary to rescue the market. Then we can think about what's happening in Europe. And if we thought that supply was assured, maybe Europe could squeeze past in this winter. And of course, that is assuming that what we get is a mild winter. If Europe gets a harsh winter, then there's going to be an energy problem. We could easily see a lot of volatility in gas prices because of the forced buying that took place in August and then the successful shoring up of reserves. And once those reserves are full, then they can't buy any more. But we are now starting to see those reserves and, or sorry, those prices pushing back up again. And UK natural gas prices were stronger in here today. So this is potentially looking like a low of at least short term and potentially medium term significance. And in the, I guess, in the event that these pressures do put significant pressure on companies and consumers, well, then governments are going to be under pressure to go in and bail them out. And of course, where does the money come from for that? So that's why we continue to see upward pressure on gilt yields, on German yields everywhere in Europe. Now, obviously, we have a quite a large overextension right now, so we could see some pause and consolidation. And both the euro and the pound were a little steadier in here today. But that's following an awfully big downward dynamic yesterday. And this is not confidence-inducing in terms of the size of the rebound. It just looks like a little pause following an enormous decline yesterday, and there's clear scope for additional weakness. So that's another thing that could break. And of course, then we have the technology sector in the USA and the large quantity of money that has been parked within the cryptocurrency markets. So Bitcoin was down another $300 today and closing below the 20,000 level. And that was an awfully big downward dynamic yesterday. So this range that's been forming for the last 4 months is still intact. And the merge for Ethereum is due within the next few hours. So that's an awfully big development for the Ethereum market. And the price right now is around 1600 and down a little. But this is the big make or break moment for Ethereum. And whether it succeeds in attracting interest, sustaining interest, and then providing the kinds of services that it's promised are going to be really big events for the rationale behind the entire cryptocurrency universe in the first place. But with the dollar continuing to be strong and liquidity conditions tightening, the issue for cryptocurrency is that it's a liquidity barometer, and prices really have difficulty sustaining when there's tight liquidity. Gold prices are back below the $1,700 area, and not in a dynamic manner, but the potential here is that it does break down because the dollar index remains so firm. The reality, unfortunately, is that a negative real interest rate environment is not a sufficient condition to support prices. We also need gold to be among the strongest currencies. I think that in the event that we do get a recession and then that the policy of the Federal Reserve will change and that they'll start removing liquidity faster after supporting the economy during a recession, then we'll get shorter, sharper cycles. That would suggest that in between those cycles, we're going to see significant dollar weakness and then strength in gold, but not until the dollar in fact rolls over. What we are starting to see, however, is that platinum is pushing higher, and it was in positive territory in here today and back up to $900. So moving in the opposite direction to gold right now. Now there's still a sequence of lower rally highs, and ultimately platinum is going to have to sustain a move above $1,000 to really confirm that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. But it is more of an industrial metal than a precious metal. And the electricity utility in South Africa, Eskom, looks to be under severe duress. So that raises the possibility of electricity cuts within the region. And the last time that happened, we had a really significant bull market in palladium. Now, they did invest in new generating equipment, and now the big question is, how are they going to find the diesel to fuel those generators? So I do think that platinum is certainly worth paying attention to. And I'm posting a report today talking about copper and the impossibility of increasing supply sufficiently to meet projected demand. But the price keeps going down, and this looks like a distribution in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So the malaise in China is more important than the promise of demand from electric vehicles. But if copper prices come down meaningfully from where they are right now, then that will stoke demand from electric vehicles. And that is a recipe for a very choppy environment overall. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.